and the situation is just relatively unimportant. To feel that who I am in my essence is beyond any limitation on the external level. So that's why I often get letters from people in prison that say, I have woken up in prison. I'm free. I'm no longer unhappy. And I have another 20 years to do. No, I'm not unhappy anymore. I rarely get letters from people who say, I've woken up because my investments are growing every year. In fact, I've never had a letter. Sometimes I get letters from people who wake up because they encounter some physical illness, and often change happens then. Any challenge is the opportunity to wake up. If you're not being challenged by life, then wait, it'll come. Now, isn't that wonderful? That means that whatever happens now is not no longer some problem that comes into your life. It's a challenge. It's not a dreadful thing. It's great. It's an opportunity to be more conscious, more present with what is. So that brings us back to the first two lines of that book. Life is difficult. Of course, it's full of challenges. But once you know that, and say, that's what it is, that's life is, then it's no longer difficult. It just is what is. It only remains difficult if you have the idea stuck in your head that it shouldn't be. It's a paradox. Life is difficult, and once you know that it's difficult, it's no longer difficult. Knowing that it's difficult implies accepting that it's difficult. But to say it is difficult only when you resist life. So what this implies is it's when the resistance goes, then it's no longer called difficult. It's challenging. It's and every challenge brings increased aliveness. My friend Steve, who is here, can testify to that because he was faced with a challenge recently of being stuck in a hotel room in Bombay with mad terrorists running all around the building for several days. And he went deep inside. Wasn't difficult for him because he was already immersed in presence for many years. So he was able to step out of the situation, which certainly could be called difficult, and go deep within into the power of the present moment, into consciousness itself. Thank you. Welcome to our private seminar. I'm talking about spiritual awakening in daily life. And some people may not be quite sure what the term spiritual awakening even means, or they may have strange ideas in their head of what spiritual is, what is spiritual and what is awakening. And instead of defining right now, I'm just going to talk about spiritual awakening in daily life. And as I talk, what spiritual means and what awakening means will hopefully emerge while we talk. So instead of defining beforehand what these things are, because although this is not a talk on philosophy, so we're not here to define terms, it's an experiential thing. It's not information based. We're here to experience something and then to bring that into daily life, live it in our daily existence. Everybody has done some traveling and sightseeing, visited unfamiliar places, European cathedrals perhaps, or the pyramids in Egypt, or Machu Picchu, Stonehenge in England, whatever it may be. And it's often an interesting experience for me to go into a place and walk around doing some sightseeing. Let's say it's a cathedral, an ancient cathedral in Europe. And you walk in there, and usually you have little groups of people with a guide. They walk around, the guide has now come this way, in different languages. The guide explains what this means, when it was built, or this is a tomb, or this king, or whoever lies there, and all kinds of interesting information. And just occasionally when I walk into a place like that, an ancient cathedral, I kind of approach the little group and just listen in and stand at the side and just see what he's saying. Sometimes quite interesting, but I never feel drawn to actually sticking around for very long, because I prefer to explore the place by myself without the interference of a voice explaining to me what things are. Now, it may well be that I may have read a guidebook beforehand, or I may not. In most cases, probably I have not looked at a guidebook beforehand. So I'm actually going into this, let's say it's a medieval cathedral. I'm walking into this medieval cathedral, not knowing very much about it, except it was built 1,000 years ago, whatever, and it took 200 or 300 years to build. But I prefer that experience of entering a space and not being burdened by information about it, rather than entering a space and immediately being bombarded with facts about it. They are two very different kinds of experiencing that place. One kind of experiencing that place is based on bits and pieces of information, on knowledge, on mental knowledge, on mind. And this is why most people travel, for that reason, because they want to learn new things. So as soon as they enter the cathedral, they say, okay, I'm going to join this guided tour. Or these days, they have invented something to substitute the human guide. You can rent a little device recording with earphones, and you can choose your language, and you put it on your ears, and then you choose your language, and then it tells you where to go. Now turn right here, stop here, and then it starts explaining it. You look, and you're continuously learning a lot. And then, okay, walk on now 10 steps, and now look up to the left, and you will see more information coming in. Very interesting. I'm learning so much about history. It's true, you are. You're learning a lot. And so you walk around this cathedral with the voice in your head teaching you about it. What's wrong with that? Nothing. It's fine. Why don't I do that? Because there is another way of experiencing, of perceiving that place. And that's not something that people even know about. Some people do it intuitively. And that way is going into that place not perceive whatever is around you through the veil of facts, information, knowledge, thoughts. Ultimately, it all comes down through thoughts, one thought after another. There is another way of perceiving that place that is not based on mind activity. And I love that other way more than the way of learning about. There's nothing wrong with that. Sometimes I read a guidebook afterwards, after I've been to a place like that. I read, oh, that's what I saw, and have a little bit of information about it. But at first, I love entering that place and perceiving, first of all, the totality of this, the vast, let's say it's a cathedral, it could be other places, but there's a spaciousness there, there's a vastness, there's a silence, interrupted, of course, sometimes by the voice of the guides here and there, and the clicking of cameras, but there is still a vastness, a silence, the whole place has a presence, there's an energy field there. And the first thing that I love to take in is to enter and to take in the totality of that energy field that is this ancient cathedral, to sense it, to feel it directly. And it has its own presence, it's an energy field. I like to get in touch with this ancient energy field, ancient and new, because it's still alive. And then look around at the architecture and so on, and again, just see the shapes, the forms, the colors. So you see, be aware also of the space itself, because anybody who goes into a place like that and is struck by something, they go, wow. Even people who later seek out the guide, there may be a few seconds when they take in this and go, they sense something, a sacred presence, you could almost say. They sense it. They don't need to know anything about it. In fact, you cannot sense the presence of that place if your mind is full of thoughts, full of knowledge. And if you enter a cathedral and you are, let's say, you are already very knowledgeable, you're a historian or whatever, and you know much, you would have to let go for a moment of all that you know if you truly wanted to experience that place. So I've always a little bit feel sorry for most tourists, because they don't seem to be aware that there is another way of experiencing life. There is another way of perceiving other than the mind, through the mind only. There's nothing wrong with the mind. It has its place and it's needed for quite a few things in your daily life. But for many other things, for realizing the depths of life and becoming a deep person, that's a strange expression is sometimes used. You say, this person has a depth, or we speak of a depth of perception. What does that mean for a person? You would say there's a shallow person and there's a deep person. What does that mean? I would say it means the what we might call a shelo person, is a person who is totally trapped only in the mind activity, the knowledge accumulated by the mind, and perceives everything through thoughts. In other words, you walk around your life like the tourist who rents this little device and comments about what they are perceiving continuously. That's fine, sometimes it may be necessary, but imagine going through life not being able to get rid of that device. You can't take it off anymore. It keeps commenting. So wherever you go in the street, it says, okay, look at that person there. And you have, and the thing even tells you whether you like it or not. This is great. I like that. Oh, I don't like that. Oh, that looks, I wish I had an answer on whatever. And of course, this is how most people live, because they're so identified with the involuntary mind activity, the little voice in the head, they don't even know it. They think they are the voice. And to live through the voice then makes your life quite shallow, because whatever you experience lacks depth. You experience it through a concept. Every thought is conceptual. So let's say you are in the street, a man or woman comes towards you, and your mind immediately has to say something about whether you like or don't like, or would like to do something with this person, whatever it may be, or have some kind of reference point, or commenting on the way they look, weird or strange or nice, or I'd love to, whatever. Is there another way of perceiving this human being? Yes, to perceive the human in the way, same way. What I said about the cathedral, if that resonates with you, if you have had a glimpse of that experience, or perhaps more than a glimpse, then you know the difference between stepping into a place and going, oh. No comment. Well, perhaps the mind says, oh, this is so beautiful, and then there's a stillness again. So there is a still space through which you perceive instead of concepts through which you perceive. And suddenly, there's a depth. Not only you feel another dimension is suddenly present, not only outside of you, another dimension that the tourist who is totally dependent on either the mechanical guide or the human guide is not aware of, that the tourist who only listens to the commentary misses the true aliveness, the sacredness, and the depth of that place. And so, also within, you are trapped in the head. There's no depth then to you as a human being, there's something that responds to life, something deeper than the commentary in your head. And so many people these days are trapped then with this guide, the tourist guide, they can't get rid of. And it's called your mind. And so, not that the mind is not a useful tool, and even in the cathedral, it adds a little bit to it if you know something about it. And I would say that's the second stage, to come back just for a moment to this cathedral analogy, one could almost say. You come back to that. Of course, ideally, and what I do that occasionally, but sometimes we don't have enough time because when we travel. First, I love to experience the place without knowing anything and truly experience it, the depths of it. And then perhaps go back to the hotel room and then look at a guidebook and then learn a few facts about it. Can be quite helpful. And then go back the next day, look at it again, and then you have a balance between knowing things about it and still being able to experience it. So in other words, you have then some information in your head, is, oh, this is, I read about that, it was built by such and such then and then, whatever. And then again you have the spaciousness where you perceive. And then you look at something else and you, oh, this is a statue of the saint so-and-so, and some knowledge about it that you have had, might have overlooked, a little detail. You can actually see a tear coming out of his eye or whatever. Oh yeah, there's a tear. He seems to be crying. Don't know why, but it seems to be. And then again, you can take it in without the commentary. So that's a little, you can experiment with that. And so I'm using that almost as just an analogy for the whole of your life. Most people are stuck with the tourist guide in the head. It comments continuously of what's going on in your life and evaluates and interprets and defines in words everything that you perceive. And so in whatever way it is defined or interpreted depends on your particular conditioning, the way you were brought up, what you were taught by the surrounding culture and so on. So the kind of tourist guide you have depends on your past. And so it's really your past talking to you continuously, certain forms of conditioning from your culture, your education, your family background, what you have read. Your fears and ambitions are also expressed there as thought structures. They become thoughts, what you would like, want, what you fear. What if that happens? Oh my God, this could go wrong. What if? Of course, so it becomes very problematic because the voice doesn't stop talking. Except occasional moments when you suddenly feel a heightened sense of aliveness. Perhaps you're out in nature and you're looking at a tree or a forest, or and for a moment you say, wow. And then after a few seconds the mind says, that's beautiful. But for about 10 seconds or 20 seconds the mind wasn't saying anything, and that's the reason why you can know that it's beautiful. Beautiful is not, the mind cannot really, the mind is concepts. There's no beauty really in that. If something from within you responds to beauty, for example, in nature, for a moment there must have been a space of where the tourist guide in the head stopped talking. And in that space, there is a deeper experiencing of whatever is there. There's a depth to your experience. What does that mean? It means, yes, what you see is the same, but the state of consciousness through which you see it has deepened. A space has opened up inside you through which the perception happens. And that's the depth. So you could say, when you look at something, and for a moment you are not interpreting what you see, there's just the seeing, and you may be aware of the background to what you see, which cannot be defined, but there's a stillness inside while you perceive. This is what I meant when I talked about entering a cathedral without the knowledge in your head. So suddenly the mind has become still and the perception happens. So you have two dimensions. You have a stillness in the background and whatever is going on outside is there. The stillness is the depth that changes your perceptions. Then you see that the tree also has a depth to it and an aliveness and a sacredness that you didn't know before when you were conceptualizing the tree and said, oh, that's a such and such a tree, and whatever knowledge you have, or this tree is in my grandmother's garden too, or this, I'd like to chop this tree up and use it as my Christmas tree, or I wonder how much it would be worth, this, the timber, if I cut it, how much the timber would be worth. You're not really, the tree is a surface phenomenon when you're in that state of consciousness, a utilitarian surface phenomenon. You cannot sense the depths, the aliveness, the sacredness of the tree, and I'm only using tree as one of many possible examples. Life, really, the tree stands for life. It could be a human being. You cannot sense the aliveness of that if you are totally trapped in conceptualization in your head. So there needs to be a depth to you in order to recognize that there is also a depth in life. Otherwise, you walk around for the rest of your life skimming the surface of life. Just every human being is a surface phenomenon because you just have judgments about them and whatever you see. It's just no depth. And then you can go into nature, and even there you will not know that nature has a sacredness to it, because you can't sense it, because you haven't, the space isn't there inside you to sense that when you go into a forest, an ancient forest, you've been there for thousands of years, that, and you cannot sense that that is a sacred space. Because otherwise you would go, wow. And then you would, and if you don't know it's sacred, and our civilization doesn't know, it looks at the forest as a utilitarian thing. How much would it be worth? So the people who cut down the ancient forests, they don't know what they are doing because they cannot sense that there's more there than what appears to be there on the surface of things. But since they themselves are trapped in the surface of their own mind only, they have no idea what they are doing when they log an ancient forest. To them, it's a utilitarian thing. You talk to them and say, what are you talking about? We are going to plant trees again. Yeah, but it'll take 1,000 years to reach that sacredness. That, no idea what you say, sacredness, what do you mean? It's a tree. We are harvesting the trees. And so, and this is one example of what happens when you cannot get out of the conceptualizing mind. Life has no depth anymore. And getting out of the conceptualizing mind is what I call spiritual awakening. So spiritual awakening has nothing to do with some kind of suddenly you have a new spiritual thoughts in your head and you start talking about angels or even God. You suddenly start talking about God all the time, and then people say, oh, he's become spiritual. No, he hasn't. He's become religious. Religious without spiritual is an ideology. You could be a communist and then talk in those terms, whatever. It's an ideology. Sometimes religious and spiritual can go together, but in many cases, religious only is just more thoughts in your head, but different kinds of thoughts. And then God, of course, becomes my God. And your God is not the right one. And then you become my enemy. And I will conceptualize you as the non-believer, for example. And the non-believers are evil, another concept. And the non-believers must be killed. Because we know the truth. And the truth is our God, concepts in the mind. You can no longer sense, and then when you do kill somebody, You're not killing a human being because you cannot sense that there is a being there, another human being. You are killing. There's a mental concept there. You have conceptualized, you have deadened, just as you've deadened the forest to yourself, you've deadened the other human being and made him into a, you put some label on. Non-believer. American. And so it's not a human being, it's American. This is, and that's how it, this is how the madness grows. So, and of course, they don't know what's happened to them. They don't realize what's happening. They are unconscious. And not unconscious in the conventional sense of the word, because unconscious in the conventional sense of the word means they're lying there. No, not that unconscious. They seem to be very conscious, seem to be very alert with their guns or whatever they're doing. But they are unconscious because they are totally trapped in the conceptualizing mind. They no longer sense the aliveness of life. They have deadened themselves. They don't know who they are beyond the conceptualizing mind, where they are completely identified with their belief structures. That gives them, the belief structures give them their identity, their sense of who they are. I am a whatever label they have. We are the we. We are the only true, etc., etc. And then it's the others, it's the others, them. They're not alive. They're just, they're concepts. So it's easy to, when you no longer sense what you're doing, to kill another human becomes easy because you no longer know that the human, the depth of the human being has disappeared. And that's perhaps why Jesus on the cross said, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." They have, in other words, they are unconscious. They have not awakened. And so we are coming here from the tourists going into a cathedral. We've arrived at terrorists. Just an extension of and really what is considered a normal state of consciousness and what it does to you to be trapped in that your whole life is a dreadful fate and the reason why we have on this planet, why we have arrived at such a point of extreme crisis is that this state of consciousness that we have been trapped in for thousands of years has created and is creating increasing havoc and destruction. It destroys nature, it destroys human beings destroying each other. What we do externally is always a reflection of the predominant collective state of consciousness. And if you read the 20th century history, you see what human beings have done to each other. The only conclusion you can reach is they are mad. It's quite mad. And 20th century is just the most extreme form of that madness, where human beings kill each other by the millions. Often they don't even know what for. In the end, you don't even know anymore what the whole thing is for. The First World War, what was that whole thing about? And then the First World War led to the Second World War, and so on, and innumerable other wars. So we need the spiritual awakening then is for the planet or humanity to survive is an absolute necessity. So there's a depth of consciousness to you of which the thought activity is only like little ripples. You could say there's a vast ocean or lake, very deep, with lots of waves and ripples on the surface. And the waves and ripples on the surface are the thoughts in your head. And so most people are trapped on that level. They don't realize that there is a depth underneath that that is vast. And that if they ever wanted to become creative human beings or bring anything new into this world, it would have to come from the depths. It can't come from this just the surface activity of your mind. It's a repetitive, continuously same kind of thing. Nothing creative can ever happen on that level alone. One day I'm going to compose a great piece of music. One day I'm going to write a great book. Just have to wait. Well, not if you don't get out of that. Of course, the mind is needed to write a book, yes. But you cannot have a deep or inspired thought if you don't make room, a moment for the depth inside you so that you touch something deeper. You need to become still for a moment when you sit in front of your computer or piece or notepad and want to write something new and creative, bring something new into this world. Well, where does that come from? From the repetitive noise in your head? No. It comes if for a moment the repetitive noise in your head subsides. That's the moment of stepping into the cathedral. Ah. And then you wait. So there's a... open yourself to the stillness inside. It's there. You don't have to make yourself still. Underneath, even in the most mad, the maddest person, underneath that, there is the realm of stillness. They just can't touch it. It's there. So it's very easy to actually embrace, say, okay, you don't need to think all the time. You need to have spaces of no thought, and it's not that difficult. Unless you're totally mad. But not that many people are totally mad. Most people are partially mad. And the madness comes up occasionally in a more acute form. It's there, so can you walk into the cathedral and be there as an aware presence rather than a mind burdened with knowledge? Can you walk along the street and look at another human being without commenting? Just look. And sense, when there's no commenting, you can sense there's an aliveness in the other human being. There's an essence there that is deeper than your mind and deeper than their mind. And if you then communicate with that human being, while you listen to them, can you be still inside while you listen? You might be talking about the weather, it doesn't matter. But be still and just be there as the space for that human being, as you are there. You are there at the space, as the space for the tree, and realize what an incredible phenomenon this tree is. Beyond anything that you could know about it through the mind, what you know may be useful for certain things, but there's a depth to that thing that we call tree that you cannot capture through that, but you can sense something. And the more you sense it outside, the deeper you go within. And there is an even greater depth in another human being. And the more you sense the depth of aliveness in another human being, the more you sense it in yourself. It always goes together. So relationships become problematic if both parties are totally trapped in their noise-making mind. Then very quickly conflict arises in relationships. And that's why relationships are full of conflict, because people can't get out of that. They are trapped in here. So every discussion, when they disagree, becomes conflict. You have an opinion, this is how it is, I'm right. You identify with your mental position, your partner has a different mental position. No, you're not, I'm right. You identify with your opinion. Identify means your sense of self is in the thought that you have, in your mental position of this is how it is. Today it's cold. Your partner says, no, it's not cold, it's just mild. No, it's cold. I'm just giving an oversimplified example. This, even that could lead to an argument, because you are you accusing me of being a liar? All moving in concepts. Well, you did lie last week when I wasn't lying, I was just and it goes on and on and on. So you're, and it's all happened, it's all, the entire relationship is mind, mind against mind. So you identify with mind, and that becomes the ego, the me, that needs to be right, always. If the ego is wrong, it's death. Thinks, I'm dead, I'll die, can't be wrong. I need to defend my position. Dreadful fate. But it's normal. So, having realized then that what is needed is to awaken out of complete identification with the continuous stream of thinking in your mind. Okay. Well, how do we do that? Simple first step is to realize that there is a continuous stream of thoughts in your mind. This is the first step of awakening. It's not saying I shouldn't be thinking. No, the first step is to realize that there is a voice that talks most of the time inside you. And perhaps that until now, you had been so identified with the voice that was you. You were talking to yourself. Sometimes people talk to themselves as I. Sometimes people talk to themselves as you. You have a little voice that says, you should have done that. Why didn't you do that? You're talking to, the voice is talking to some other voice. And then perhaps there's an answer. Well, I couldn't help it. Yeah, but you should have. So sometimes the voice splits itself into different voices, talking to each other, becomes even more mad. And sometimes the voice also can have certain streams, that one stream of the voice only comes up in certain circumstances. What some psychologists, they have discovered that this is the case, some psychologists call it sub-personalities. So in certain circumstances, perhaps a whining little girl suddenly comes up, but you're 30 years old, why are you still, it's a sub-personality. And suddenly you have a whining voice in your head that complains about how unfair life is treating me. It's a sub-personality talking. And then when that subsides, something else happens, and another voice suddenly comes in and becomes extremely aggressive. Another stream, another aspect of that has arisen. And so you, sometimes different voices take over, but really it all belongs ultimately to the one thing, the one voice in your head. So the first step to awakening, the beginning of awakening, is to realize there's a voice in my head. And it's especially useful to realize in the moment of it saying, for example, voices have old, most of the mind activities, old thoughts, old patterns, repetitive thoughts. For example, I had, when I was younger, I had a frequent thought that said, whenever something that wasn't good happened to me, or that my mind interpreted as not good, the voice in my head would say, "Yeah, you see, bad things always happen to you." And then I was just waiting for the next bad thing to confirm that I was right. And it would never have to wait for very long, and something else would go wrong in my life, and I would say, "You see, it's happening again. You're always bad things to you. I don't know why, it's always you." And then, of course, you experience the emotion that goes with that kind of thought. And I completely believed in that thought. I was so identified with that thought, I didn't realize this is just a thought in my head. It's not the reality. It's a conditioned way of interpreting the phenomenal world, the world outside you. And so the liberation then comes with beginning to realize, oh, the voice is saying the same thing again and again and again, and it's not me, it's the voice. Who realizes that? You. So there is a deeper dimension is suddenly there when you become aware that all the stuff that your mind is saying to you and to others when you have is not ultimately who you are. But the awareness that at this moment your mind is reproducing the same old thoughts, there you're beginning to touch the depths that is within yourself, that we could call the awareness, the aware presence. Because knowing that there is thought in my head is not a thought, it's just a looking, an internal aware. Why do bad things always happen to me? And then you look at the thought and you realize a thought. So you begin to, one could almost say, you listen to your thoughts, you become aware of the kinds of thoughts you think. And when this is, for many people, the first awakening. And what people realize when they first awaken, not everybody, because some people's thoughts are not too bad. They can live with it quite well. They saw their thought activity is not predominantly negative. But many people actually find that when they become aware of their thoughts, they realize how many thoughts are actually negative. The majority of people become aware that the larger part of your mind activity is negative thoughts. There are far more negative thoughts than positive thoughts. Not in everybody. Some people have quite a few positive thoughts. One could almost say it's easier for people who are trapped in a lot of negative thinking to step out of their thinking than people who have relatively nice thoughts. Their inner urge to awaken is not as strong. If you live in a self-made nightmare, as I did, the impulse to awaken is much stronger than you really, I can't stand my mind anymore. I don't want to live with this mind anymore. Oh, that's good. It doesn't mean you have to kill yourself. It just means you have to realize that your mind is not who you are. You are the awareness behind your mind. You are the space, because the awareness is space. It's not a thought, it's consciousness. So we are now slowly getting to what spiritual awakening is, because we have looked at what spiritual sleep is. We've seen what it means to be asleep or unconscious, normal, in other words, normal existence. The entire world, not the entire world, there's some awakening here and there. More and more people, in fact, are awakening, going through the awakening process. We now know what that is, because it means you're no longer identified with the mind. Who are you if you're not your mind? You are the consciousness out of which every thought comes. And then it plops back, it's like a wave or ripple. You are the consciousness that is far greater than any single thought, or even greater than the totality of thought. And that consciousness is experienced when you first you touch it as inner stillness. Stillness doesn't mean you go to sleep. It means the mind is Where the mind was before, there's a space. And out of that space comes all creativity. Every great realization or insight that any human being has ever had, the creative impulse comes out of the vast intelligence that is there. And then the mind, it flows into the mind, and the mind becomes an instrument for that. And that's how the mind can be a beautiful thing. When it's not just self-serving, but it is serving something greater than itself. The mind as a master is mad. The mind as a servant is a great thing. So that's the shift in consciousness that is happening and needs to happen on this planet. The mind finds its place as the servant of consciousness or awareness. So it's up to you then to invite the consciousness that you are beyond the mind into your daily life. And how do you do that? You do that by inviting space or inner stillness into your life. For example, while you make a cup of tea or coffee, why not try to practice being still with every movement? Just be aware, bring awareness into that every movement. Pour the water, no commentary. Look at a flower, look at a tree, look at the sky, and for just a few seconds, just look. Listen to the wind, listen to the rain, listen to whatever sound you can hear, and just listen. Bring the attention to sense perceptions. Attention to sense perceptions. That means the mind is quiet while you listen. The mind is quiet while you look. And that's a little practice that you can do many times during the day, and it will deepen your life. It will bring spaces into an otherwise an existence that goes from one thing that you have to do to another thing you have to do and another thing you have to think about now. There's no gaps. So the gaps are vital in daily life, inviting gaps into your daily existence, looking for the gaps in daily existence, in everyday situations. A helpful thing, as many of you already know, is to feel that your body is actually alive inside. Normally people are not aware of that because their whole attention is on thought activity. But if you can feel that your body is alive, so the attention is, some attention can be in the energy field of your hands, and you feel, yes, they feel alive. There is an aliveness that pervades the entire body. Your body is full of life, but most people can't feel that. So if you can feel the inner body, that you are alive inside, that the entire body at this very moment is a vibrating, alive energy field, and it actually feels good to have some of your attention there, even while you're looking around the room. You can just, for people who are new to this, can just start by doing it with their hands, feel the aliveness that's in your hands. You can feel it perhaps even more with your eyes closed. And then you can still feel it even when your eyes are open. Simultaneous thing, you're present inside your body and you're present outside in your sense perceptions. What does that do? It means your mind becomes quite still because you can't be thinking also at the same time because you're already present in the body and you're present outside. You become awake, really awake to this moment then. And your mind, there's not enough attention left then for thinking. Part of your attention is in the inner body and part of your attention is on your perceptions. And what you perceive then is more alive than it was before. It's more surprising. it has more depth to it. Every human being is more interesting then, more really there. New things are, you no longer feel that you're experiencing the same old thing again and again. Life then is always new. Every day is a new day. It's not a repetition. As people grow older, they reach 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, and for many people, life becomes more and more boring because it's so repetitive. And they no longer look anywhere. They go every day, they go to work, the same place. They don't look at anything anymore. There's nothing to look at. I looked at it yesterday and last year and 5 years ago. What's there to look at? And even people they live with for a few years, after a few years, you don't look at your wife or husband anymore. They are part of the furniture. And you don't look at your paintings anymore on the wall because they've been there for too long. You don't look, they're old. And really, nothing new. And then you become that kind of person who said, I've seen it all, don't tell me about it. I know it all, I know that kind of person, I know that kind of thing. Yeah, I've been there, done it. Life becomes more and more dull, been there, done it. You're not there and you're not... And so that's the fate of many people as they grow old in our civilization. And only a few, perhaps an increasing number now because more and more people are awakening spiritually, they remain alive, perhaps even become more alive as they grow older. And then you have a truly... And then the person doesn't actually, you don't get, even if they are 70, 80 years old, you don't get the impression that they are old people because there is a light shining through their eyes, there is an aliveness to them. And occasionally you meet people like that. They may be old in terms of calendar years, but they are not old inside because they are not burdened by their mind anymore. Their mind can be used, but they are no longer being used by their mind, which says, I already know all this. And so every day is new and fresh, and every moment is still alive, because you're not putting your past, you're not obscuring it with past, the accumulated past in your head, putting it onto the aliveness of the present moment, stifling the aliveness of the present moment. And so then spiritual awakening is then intrinsically connected with the aliveness of the present moment, the only place where life is. And so you are more and more open to the now rather than live continuously in past and future, which is normal. For most people, it's future, until they reach a certain age where there's not much future left, and then they live mostly in the past. That's why many old people continuously talk about the past. And the younger people continuously think about their future, where they're going to finally make it someday and find fulfillment in some future. When they have done or this, achieved this, whatever it may be, it could be a big house or recognition, or for spiritually inclined people, it could be enlightenment. But it's put into the future. As I'm going to reach that place and then I'll be finally fully myself, fulfilled, happy, alive. I will become alive one day. Fully alive, but without $10 million in the bank, I don't think I can feel alive. Because I really need to have that sense of security, you know. I need the sense of security without which I'll just be in fear the way I've always been. And you'll be surprised if the $10 million happen to come to you for a few weeks, you will feel alive. And one night you'll wake up and you'll be in the same fear as before. because